The Sunstone Foundation presents Interracial Marriage in the Mormon Community. Recorded live at the 1989 Sunstone Symposium held August 23rd through 26th in Salt Lake City, Utah. We now take you to the University of Utah campus where the program is about to begin.
Welcome all of you to our panel discussion on interracial marriage in the church. My name is Stuart Pace. This is my wife, Gilan Pace, and then Robert and Shannon Booker. We'll each introduce ourselves in turn and tell a little bit about how we got into interracial marriage and how we've perceived it as being accepted in our experiences in the church. First of all, my parents are both from Utah, but I grew up in upstate New York where my father is an engineer with FMC Corporation. And I served a mission for the LDS Church in Buenos Aires, Argentina. And after my mission, I came back and went to BYU, where I ended up majoring in Greek. And after my first year there, I went to France for the summer and got a job in a pizza place because I had taken a lot of French in high school and didn't want to lose my French. Thought that that would be really the best way to work on it. While I was in France, I went to the Young Adult Board in Paris. And my first week there, I think, I saw Gilan and noticed her. And I guess we met each other and talked during the first couple weeks, but we didn't get to be close until after I was there for a month or two. And we started dating, and before the end of the summer, we had fallen in love, and I asked her to marry me. And she said, when I asked her to marry me, she gasped. And then she excused herself to go get a drink of water. And I sat there for about 5 minutes, and then she came back. She gave me a hug and said yes. So I felt great. But then 3 days later, or 3 days? 7 days later, I caught the plane and went home. And when I got to the airport and I called my parents to tell them that I was coming home, I announced my engagement to them. And my mother said, and when I said I was engaged, my mother said, "Oh no," because before I went over to France, she had said, "Whatever you do, don't fall in love over there." And when I got home, all the while I was on the plane, I think my parents were panicking because I had written to them about my various associates and friends while I was here, and they knew that a black girl was among them, but they weren't sure which name I had given them over the phone. And it turned out that when I got home, I got off the plane at the wrong airport, and my parents were waiting for me in Buffalo, and I was in Rochester, and I was sitting there waiting at the airport for a while, and then a phone call, a page came over, and I went up to the phone and answered it, and my mother was there, and she said, "Oh, you're there, good, we'll come and get you, we're at Buffalo, you got off at the wrong place." I had figured that out by then. And then she asked, "Is she the black girl?" And I said, "Yes," and she said, "Oh," and then she said goodbye and hung up, and then they came and got me at the airport. And I understand that my dad was teasing her all the way. Well, he had been teasing her all the way to the Buffalo airport, saying, "I bet it's the black girl. I bet it's the black girl." And she was just dying. And when she came and picked me up, we talked about it. And I didn't. When in describing Gilan, it was difficult to get beyond the fact that she was black. But I did say nice things about her, of course. I guess what else could I say? During the next couple weeks, my mother drove us out to Utah for me to go to school that fall, and she was persisting in the belief that it was a political or social statement that I was making, and that I couldn't really be serious about this. But with time, she did come to accept it. It really surprised me, because my mother
My mother subscribed to Sunstone, I think, since its inception, and she went to all the exponent conferences, and she even wrote my mission president and asked me to come home a week early so that she could meet me at the airport and wouldn't have to miss any of her exponent conference in Massachusetts. Yeah, well, he sent me home a week early, and I didn't get to say goodbye to anybody. But I appreciate that. And, well, anyway, back to the subject. It surprised me that she was the one in my parents who, the one of my parents who seemed to be most opposed to the idea that I would marry a black girl, because when we were younger, expletives about racial expletives or other ethnic slurs were not acceptable in my house, and she enforced that with as much vigor as she did cursing and other blasphemes. And so it didn't seem to be consistent with her character as I had understood it. My father, on the other hand, was just he's an engineer, and he's a pragmatist, and he's not really concerned with he spent his life as a branch president in a small town, and he didn't seem to be as concerned with, you know, deep morality, but just with essential goodness. I don't know if that's the way to explain it. But when he found out that I was getting married to a black girl, it didn't seem to make any difference to him. I got the impression that when he was talking to me about marriage, he had the same attitude that he had had with my other brothers and sisters when they had announced their marriages. My mom has essentially been opposed to all of our marriages, so I guess it's not a big deal. But then when I got to BYU and I told my roommates that I was engaged, the general consensus that I got was one of, well, if that's what you really want to do, Stuart, but it's going to be hard on the kids. And that didn't seem too strong, but when I thought about the fact that most Americans seem to think that blacks have it easy in this country, and that there's no real difference between the races, that the blacks couldn't overcome if they had a little more initiative, or if they had a little more get up and go and were more serious about their education. It seems to be inconsistent with the fact that when I told them that I was going to be marrying a black girl, that they thought that it was unfair to the children, that that they would have a lot of hardships to go through, and that it wouldn't, and they would resent the fact that I had made this decision. It just didn't seem consistent to me. I think on the one hand you can either assume that the problems with race in America lie with the minorities or with the majority, but you can't say that it's all the blacks' problem and then say that someone's going to have more trouble in their life simply because they're black or of mixed race. I guess I'll let Guylaine finish by talking about the rest of our courtship and our marriage, and then I'll pass the time on to the book.
My name is Guylaine Pace, and our little boy is in the back. His name is Richard.
I'd like you to stand
up. Oh, they want me to stand up. Oh. Yeah, but
it's a recording mic.
Okay, I'll try to speak up. I've been living in Utah. Well, I'm from Paris, France, and I've been living in Utah for 3 years now. I'm concerned to. Well, I've been concerned to come here. At first, I didn't want to come and talked about my interracial marriage with my husband because I thought that we were chosen just because we were different, and we are, of course, but I changed my mind because I'd like to share our experiences and hope that in the future in a longer time we won't need to express our feelings because we are different. When I decided to marry Stuart in France, I knew that we will have some problems because the blacks of course in the church didn't have the priesthood for so many years, and I knew also that interracial, intercultural marriage were not have not been encouraged by the general authorities through the years. They have made statements in general conference about it, and of course, faithful members of the church have taken that literally and applied them in their life and told us. But anyway, I think I written some notes because I was concerned because it's the first time I talk about the subject in public. Do you hear me? Yeah, okay. When I announced in my ward and Stuart and I we were engaged, the ward was split in half. They were the one who supported us and say, well, you should do it. It's really important, no matter what the general authorities and what the statement has been made in the church. You should think about your love and help the other members in the church to understand that you love each other and that's what's most important. And then there was the other half in the ward. I kind of had a little persecution because in the Book of Mormon, like you say, like you know, each time the Lamanites will become darker is because they are not close to God. So they are still. Well, there are a lot of members who think in Europe that you should take that literally, and so blacks, because they are dark, they are not righteous children of God, and so and they came up and told me. I mean, I had talks with members of the world who told me that I was sinning because I loved a white person. And they told me, they remind me what the general authority said about that. And at the other end, my mother, my dad is white, and my mom is black, and my parents are divorced. And my mom, she was against it at first because she said, "Oh, you are going to marry a Mormon, white, return missionary, capitalist, American," and yeah, she did give him all of those epithets, and I said, "Yeah, I'm going to," and she said, "But Ghislaine, could you imagine? I mean, did you remember what I taught you over the years? Americans are well, in Europe, the biggest epithet, I should say, that Americans have is well, they had slavery in their country, and they are racist, and they are capitalists because they think only about money." Well, anyway, and so my mom, she told her over the years for her she couldn't understand why I wanted to make a statement or something because she said, "Did I teach them well? What's wrong with them?" I mean, and so she was opposed, and on my dad's side, interracial marriage is common because I have an uncle who is Vietnamese and I have German cousins, it's something it's not uncommon. But they are racist against blacks because my mom is from Martinique, and in Martinique they still have colonies, white French colonies. And my dad, I mean, the family of my dad is they are French white colonists, and they don't marry by tradition black person. They don't they do have sexual relations with them, but they don't marry them. And so my dad he had problem with his family also, and he ended up in a divorce. And my mom was concerned that will have happened to us between Stuart and I. So she was very concerned about that. I think it's for me it has been harder. Well, the time it had been harder in our relationship was where we were engaged, because people remind you. What's going to happen to your kids? What you are not doing what the church is asking from you? How is it going to be? From the beginning, you are putting barriers, problems in your relationship because that there are still prejudices and it's not something accepted. And besides, my husband wasn't only white; he's also American. So it's interracial and intercultural marriage. But once we were married, I think our parents and the members of the church and the world, they had to deal with it. I mean, if you go to church, they have to talk to you. I mean, they cannot let you be in the back and pretend that you're not there. So they have to deal with you and even force themselves to be nice with you sometimes, but and go over their prejudices because. When we go to church, of course, well, between Stuart and I, I do not think when I see my husband, when I get up in the morning, he's white. I mean, my husband is for me a person above all. He's intelligent. I mean, I was seduced because he's intelligent, because he's calm, because he's open, because of those qualities and not because he was white. I hope not, because I will have a psychological problem if that happened. And so when we go to the store or when we go to school or when we walk on campus, I don't think that way. And sometimes it reminds you because some people look and say, they are different. The reason and what I think how should I put this? If in the Mormon community, if I haven't had problems, it's because I haven't had enough tools to detect them, or maybe because I have already put aside the the color problem or the cultural problems, because by nature I'm an open person, and I feel myself like as a woman and a person above all, and a friend of mine told me I was talking to her about having Stuart in the class because she 3 years ago Stuart took a class from a Spanish professor and she was in the class, and she said at that time, Gillian, I didn't know you, and one day, and Stuart of course, well, Stuart is a very good student, he's a Kimball scholar, and so he gave really good comments in class, and so people notice him. So she said, it was very surprising for me when I saw Stuart on campus holding hands with a black woman. I thought, that intelligent guy with a black woman. And I really liked my friend. I mean, Trisha, I really liked her. And she spent some years in more than half of her life in South America. And it didn't hurt me, but it touched me. Excuse me. He did hurt me. Stuart said he did hurt me, but I was shocked, surprised. Then my good friend would would see our differences and would accept me only as a person. But now she did, because she knows me. But I think if people have prejudices, maybe it's because they don't know blacks in general, or because their traditions. The last comment I'd like to make is here. I don't feel being persecuted, or I don't feel prejudices. Maybe because I'm a woman, and maybe it's easier for a minority woman to live in a community. Maybe because also I'm French, and also because I speak exotic language and have an exotic cooking, whatever. I don't know, but I haven't felt so much. Well, that's all I think I have to say. I would let you.
I wrote notes. Is it okay if I sit down? Well, for those of you who were here last night, I'm not LDS. And I hope I don't sound like a critic instead of a counselor. The people who were here last night will know what I mean. I really hope that I don't end up sounding like a critic or like we're persecuted people. We're normal people. People have asked me, does he eat different food? People put on us, I think when it's a white woman and a black man, people put different views on you, and there are different stereotypes. A white woman is promiscuous, the black man, you know, just wants to get a white woman. Different things like that. We get up in the morning, we have breakfast, we play with our children, we have arguments about doing the chores, we're normal people. And I hope I don't, you know, and it, like Eileen said, it doesn't affect our lives. I don't wake up in the morning and go, I'm white, my husband's black. What should we do today about that? You know? We have a life. And so I hope, and it doesn't really affect us. There have been times when it comes up, and I'm going to share a few of those with you. So I hope it doesn't sound like that's what our life is about, is all I'm saying. I grew up in northern Minnesota in a town about the size of Provo, Orem, and there wasn't much diversity at all. I was in sixth grade before I saw a black person. And it was Robert, when I was 24, was the first black person I ever touched. There just are not many black people at all. The only minorities that are really there are the Indians that are in reservations and the migrant workers who come up for the summers. And actually, they're discriminated against more, I think, because there are more of them. But looking back, I think it's really ironic and actually fitting that I did end up marrying a black person or some kind of minority person. I looked for diversity all my life. And like Stuart's family, it was taught in my home that we are all equal, that we should share, that we should be okay with each other. And I always felt really bad when I heard the story of Sambo or Catch a Nigger by the Toe and things like that. And I always thought, well, you know, something doesn't seem right with that. It doesn't correlate with... I'm an English major now, and I've always done a lot of reading. And even when I was like in first and second grade, I would go out and search the library for minority books on different cultures, race, gender issues. And I always found that minority and women, female writers, even as a child, would deal with two things more. They would deal with emotional aspects in their book more. They knew that happiness comes if you don't have much. I think this is a real minority perception, not a female perception, that if you don't have much, you find happiness in emotion. You find happiness with your family, with the people that you love and that you care about. And I think it also deals with fairness. It tries to deal with justice, whether it's there or not, and how to get that justice. The recognition that there is a problem has always been really important to me. And I don't mean to step on any toes, but I think we all know that the white male power system, the power system in our country. And when you are the power system, you don't need to change. You don't need to acknowledge necessarily that there are problems. It's great when people do, but you don't necessarily need to. And I think most standard American literature is in that white male perspective, and it's really role limiting, and it's just sort of homogenized people to me. And so, you know, I started out in my life looking for difference. I stuffed those values to please my family and ended up marrying somebody who looked really right. He came from a successful family, middle class, white, but he ended up being really messed up, and said it his family, and I ended up divorced with a two-year-old when I went back to college. Now I started getting back in touch with my values, and I directly confronted minority or feminist issues in classes and in my life. I found myself relating more and more to women's issues as I was discriminated against with child support collection, with being dealt or needing to deal with class issues from going from sort of a middle class income to living in a poverty level, trying to go back to school with children or with a child. Cultural attitudes towards women who are divorced. I think I really needed to start dealing with issues that stereotype people because of their appearance of their body, gender, because of what our body is. We need to deal with stereotypes, race, income, class issues, and I think most of my dating ended up showing to me anyway that for what I needed, like white American males were just not as interested in social change, in unfairness, in emotions. The guys that I ended up dating that were American wanted to talk about the football games or, you know, don't get so serious, why do you need to deal with that, let's just, you know, have a beer and be happy, or, you know, something like that. And that's just not me at all. I ended up dating a lot of European people or, you know, non-Americans that I had as friends also besides just dating. And of course, then I met Robert. And Robert was the first black that I ever knew closely. It was sort of scary. We'd date, and I was like, oh, do I dare? What's this like? And it was. It was really different. There were a lot of stereotypes that even as a person who wanted diversity, that I understood intellectually and from reading, but I had never had experiences with any black people at all. I thought one of the biggest things that was surprising to me was that there is reverse prejudice in the black community. When I would read like some black feminists or black magazines, they are very against especially educated black men marrying outside of the race, and so it does come from both directions. And that's, I was just like, oh, I thought they all wanted to marry us, you know, sort of, you know, or at least I heard that from my family, and that it really did surprise a lot of people that there is discrimination coming from the other side too. When Robert got on the phone with his family, all 11 of his brothers and sisters, right down the line, said either is she white or. You know, is she black? They all asked because they knew where he'd been living. There aren't that many black people. And or so it seems apparent that you do end up marrying somebody white. Then we moved to Utah. Robert wanted to go to BYU Law School. And so he moved out to Utah. And I really thought that Mormons would be really accepting of outsiders, other cultures, because Mormons go on missions, because Mormons have been a persecuted religion, a persecuted people, and so they would understand like a underdog sort of position, like minorities, like women, just, you know, wanting social change, because I think the LDS community has affected a lot of change. And, you know, so it just made sense to me. Then we moved to Provo. And this is where I might start sounding like a critic, and I was thoroughly disappointed. I soon learned that didn't appear to be the case, but I heard so many missionary stories cutting down other cultures, cutting down the people who lived in the other cultures, and not even wanting to get to know the other cultures, just wanting to say they're not American, they don't do things like we do. I'm so glad to be back home and bring home a poncho or a little African statue and put it on their mantle and say, whew, I'm liberated, you know, and that really hurt me. I would go to forums trying to learn about the community, to learn about the culture, and it seemed very closed. When the answers to people's questions, the answers to people's inquiries would be, this is God's chosen land, God's chosen people, God's chosen school, and therefore these are God's chosen roles, and you better conform. And I think that the other thing I was going to say, my class is at BYU. I found out in a religion class in the Book of Mormon that the worst souls are the darkest souls in the pre-existence. The darker you are, the worse you were in the pre-existence. When I questioned that, Brother Anderson said to me, "Well, you're blonde, you're fair, you need not worry about it." And you know that didn't sit well either. I think most of the things that I really know, I guess what's really interesting to me is that you probably know a whole lot better than I do what it's like, what people think of interracial marriages, what people think of black people. The only things I learn now, for the most part, are things that I hear behind closed doors, like hearing this from my religion people. I doubt that if he knew I was married to Robert, or if there were black people in the room, that he would have said that. He also said, well, actually it was in the study guide to the Book of Mormon, that when children become LDS and adopted into LDS families, they'll become lighter. That is written in black and white in the textbook. These things carry strong implications. It not only says that you'll become lighter, but it also carries the reverse effect that the darker you are, the more evil you are, the more sinful you are. And I think that's the attitude that I have found, is that as a minority or as a woman, you deserve what's happening to you in this life, and we don't need to change. That's been my experience in the Mormon community, at least in Provo. When we moved up to Salt Lake City, our 7-year-old's teacher, Jessica, came home, and I said, "Oh, who's this family on her picture?" And she said, "Well, that's our family." And I said, "Well, Jessica, usually you draw our family a little more true." And I said, "Who's that?" And she said, "That's Jasmine. Jasmine is her. She's got a friend who's mixed." And I said, "Well, why is Jasmine blonde and why is Dad blonde?" And she said, "Mrs. Soderbergh told me I may only draw white people. My people need to be peach." And I said, "Oh, I agreed." And I called up the teacher and said, "You know, where is this coming from?" And she said, "Well, I only meant that I didn't know that your husband was black, and I only meant that we must be politically correct, if you would, in our drawings. Christopher Columbus must be peach because he's white." And my opinion was Christopher Columbus is Hispanic. Most Hispanic people that I know aren't peach and blonde either. And you know, so we've run into things like that. But also, the only direct stuff that I have ever had to deal with, and I think people say things to women more often than they would to me with Robert. Maybe it has something to do with his being about 6'4" and very athletic. But yeah, I'll thump him with his cast. But when his mother was here, we had several experiences, his mother and I. I think, and I really believe it was because we were women, that people dared to come up and directly say something to us. The one that was the most interesting was a man at the police station. I had gotten a ticket that I didn't deserve and went down to dispute it. And Robert's mother and I were standing there, or sitting there with our baby, and it was very obvious that we were together. And this man came over and said, "Does she work for you?" And I said, "No, this is my mother-in-law." And he went on for about 20 minutes telling us how he had done some study in the 70s and knew that most women who married black men are sluts and tramps and out, you know, in front of his mother. And it was really embarrassing. And I dearly hope that isn't what most people are thinking, although I know that, you know, most of us do have some kind of prejudices and social concepts in our, you know, in our minds that are hard to get rid of, especially when we don't know many minorities. But you know, like I don't know. But what happens too is people start being really friendly. And I think oftentimes because they're curious, and will say things like, "I have neighbors who are a mixed couple. You should meet them." And I really like it when people ask questions and you know, when people are curious. And I think both of us feel sort of a social responsibility. We don't often, you know, like I guess we'd think about it if we were going to park in a handicapped space or something. People would go, "Oh, those black, you know, black people, oh, that's, you know, And, you know, or when we lived in Provo, and I would wear like a swimming suit out on the lawn, I would think, oh no, they're going to think, you know, such and such. And I think we do think about it in that way. But I didn't choose my husband for his race, and I think it's sort of ironic that people would expect us to choose our friends on that basis. But I guess that's about all I have to say. I guess the only other thing that I wanted to say is that most of the racism that we encounter is underlying, and you can feel it, but it doesn't directly affect you, and you don't quite know what to do with it. Robert used to say, it's better in the South because then you know exactly what's coming up against you. And I've come to understand that position much more than I ever thought I could. I think that we should be the ones asking you questions so we could find out what the truth is, so we could find out what you really think of us, because we really don't know. People don't accept, you know, people don't tell us directly.
It's kind of funny. Most of the time, I think all of us, after you live with someone for a long time, you just kind of see your wife. You know, you don't. And as I was sitting here listening to Shannon, I realized she is very impressive. I mean, all of a sudden, I just realized why I married her. I mean, she's. I don't know if that makes a whole lot of sense, but just every once in a while, it just dawns on you that wow. And that kind of leads into how I feel about being black, and. One of my biggest problems is that most of the time I don't think of myself as a man. I mean, I just think of myself as Booker. And every once in a while, like about a week ago, we went up to Park City to watch a play. And all of a sudden, someone was looking at me when I turned. They kind of shuffled to keep from staring. And all of a sudden it dawned on me, oh, that's right, I'm a black man. And he's looking to see if I'm going to do anything different. And that's also kind of what happened. I'm a law student down at BYU. And I clerked for a firm here in Salt Lake this summer. And the first couple weeks that I was there, no one ever said, well, only one person came in and said something to me. For the most part, no one said anything and no one did anything. But more often than not, I could feel people looking and waiting to see, when's he going to do something black? And I mean, after a while, they just kind of came to see that, well, there goes Booker. You know, and if they were explaining who I was to someone else, they would probably say, he's the black gentleman going up the stairs. But after a while, once people get to know me, they don't really think of me as a black person. And hopefully that's something that everybody can take with them is, you know, like this experience I just had watching Shannon is, you know, to kind of cut through all the stuff that builds up over years and just think about, you know, who she is and some of the qualities that she has. And I do think that Shannon made an excellent point in that minority literature, and I think often women's literature, does try to deal with fairness and, you know, what the truth is and what's honest, because it's necessary. There have been so many things even in my life that just aren't fair. And you end up searching for some kind of fairness or some kind of an explanation. For example, my mother grew up in the same county that my father did, but when she finished the eighth grade, she had to drop out of school because there wasn't a black school in her town. There was my county only had enough money to build one black high school. Fortunately, my father lived close enough so that he could walk. My mother didn't live. She lived outside of the major town. And, I mean, there just wasn't any choice. I also cut my hand when I was 12 years old. I cut my index finger, and it was a very serious accident. And one of the first things I told Shannon, and it was something that I had just never really thought that much about, but I told Shannon that, you know, if this had happened 2 years earlier, I would have had to go to the black doctor in my hometown. He would have cut the finger completely off because I would not have been allowed into the white hospital. That's just the way it was. And I had never quite thought about it in the sense that it's unfair. But that's just two examples of the kinds of things that happen that almost force you to go out looking for some truth, some justice, some honesty, some explanation as to why things happen. Now to be more specific. Before I came to Utah, and when the first encounter I had with members of the LDS faith, I was really impressed by their ability to, and it was a really strange feeling to me, because generally I especially thought of white males as being outside of my experience. And for the first time when I met a couple of Mormon missionaries, actually, I had started to see that, hey, these guys feel like they're persecuted too. They feel like, you know, they have to defend what they believe, and they have to search for some kind of truth and justice. And that's what I expected when we came to Utah. And as Shannon pointed out, we moved to Provo. It was different from what we expected. And it was saddening a lot of times, because we did run into the attitude, well, if you don't like it, leave. That just doesn't satisfy me. I mean, I have nowhere to go. I could not. In fact, I think in the 1920s, there was a Back to Africa movement among some blacks. They moved to, I think it's Liberia, and about half of the population died because they didn't have the same immunities that the people indigenous to Africa now have built up over the years. And I mean, most blacks are probably about as similar to whites who grew up in this country, and they just couldn't survive. That's obviously an aside, but anyway, that's something that interests me. And also, as Shannon pointed out, there is kind of a reverse, and for me it's not reverse, but there is a questioning among blacks. And as Shannon said, when I called home, it happened that all 11 of my brothers and sisters, and then my two parents, and everyone who got on the phone asked, well, is she white? And I said, yeah, she's white. And I mean, after a while, we kind of got over it. But I think it really did surprise Shannon quite a bit to find that, hey, what is this? I thought blacks did all want to marry white. And it's not necessarily the case. Some examples of discrimination. This will make it more clear, like, why it's difficult at times for me to deal with racism, because it's hard to figure out where it's coming from. For example, and some of the best examples I have of racism in Utah, I'm going to point out now, it's racism. But our first week in Provo, everyone that I met, and I mean absolutely everyone, asked me, oh, do you go to school here? Yes, I go to BYU. Well, what position do you play? And, well, I did play basketball before, and I was really surprised. I thought, wow, I must really look like a good basketball player, because I played professionally in Europe, and I thought, boy, I must really look like an impressive basketball player. But that's not what they were talking about. Everyone knew black basketball player on BYU's team, and they knew I wasn't him. So everyone just assumed that I was on the football team. After a while, I realized that they weren't talking about basketball, and we were talking about different things. And then eventually they would just ask, well, aren't you on the football team? And I say, no, I go to the law school here. Really? And then there would be the shock and the surprise. And then they would say, then are you on a football scholarship in the law school? No, they don't give. I don't play football. That's one example of what I would call racism. And, I mean, it's very hard. Most of the time, it's real difficult to figure out where that's coming from. Another example is, not everyone that I met, but when we first moved to Provo, the Pierre Del Selby execution was imminent. And I had heard about the Hi-Fi murder, but I wasn't really aware that it had been committed by two black people. And the first couple weeks, everyone asked, well, what do you think about Selby? And at first, I didn't even know what they were talking about. And then they said, the Hi-Fi murder. And I said, oh, yeah, I've heard about that. And boy, that was awful. And then they kind of have to pull more. And, well, don't you think he should be executed? Well, I don't believe in the death penalty. And it would just kind of go on like that. And then eventually, I finally realized that this was a black man that everyone was talking about. And I think people were drawing some kind of a relationship. I don't know what the relationship was. I don't know what people saw when they saw me and they were bringing up Selby. And I don't really know what they were looking for. But those are the kinds of experiences I have with racism. And that's why I've said to Shannon, and as Shannon pointed out, at times I find it a whole lot easier to deal with a hardcore Southern racist than, you know, this stuff that just kind of floats around and you don't really know where it's coming from. You know, you can feel attitudes, but there's never anything to deal with. And that's often very frustrating. And I think that's been our experience together, is, you know, you can just kind of feel it and you can see it pop up every once in a while, but it doesn't really have a direction. And, you know, it's hard to figure out where it's coming from. And more importantly, you feel the need. You kind of feel this burden, but there's nowhere to go with it. You can't put that energy back out. The last couple things that I want to point out is one thing that I have heard other people call the presumption of ignorance. And it happens to some degree when I first started work with a law firm here in Salt Lake. And I think it happens even more in law school. But there's always... And again, it's never, or it's rarely, real clear and real specific. But I often feel that people are questioning my intellect and my intelligence. And again, it's hard to know what to do with it. What will often happen is people will give you a very simple problem or ask you a very simple question just to see how you're going to react. And usually I don't like that. I find it somewhat insulting because I know that this doesn't happen to everyone. But, I mean, I have to deal with it, so I usually try and take it seriously and give a good, well-thought response. But that carries over into a lot of different areas. When I was interviewing for jobs about a year ago, a very interesting thing started to happen. I would go in, I'd interview, people would say, you are a very impressive young man. You have, academically, you're doing fine. You have broad experiences and it looks like you've impressed the people that you work with. The only problem we have is we're just not quite sure how our clients would react to a black man working in our office or having a black man represent them. And, you know, again, what do I do with that? I can't hit him with this red cast and say, no, that's not. I mean, it's a difficult situation. And that is where a lot of the frustration that you hear about in inner cities come from. Is in the South, I think there's more direction. But in New York, Chicago, Los Angeles, racism doesn't come at you directly. It's just a feeling. And it's a very frustrating, very angering situation. And it causes people to want to do something about it. And I think very often that comes out, and, you know, there's just nothing else you can do. That's something I, hopefully, people will take out of here and try and do something about. That's one of the reasons I think this symposium is very important, because I don't think the dismissing response is appropriate. I think the response to say, well, if you don't like it, move to Africa, it doesn't deal with the problem. And I think if that continues to happen, there will be violent reactions to that, because people want to live. They want to be respected. They want to be acknowledged. And they want to have a piece of the action. I have a note.
I think that the only people that really own the racism in our experience has been cops. Robert's been harassed several times by police officers. When he first moved to Provo, or when he came out to check the school out, he and an American Indian were walking down the street and were stopped and almost arrested because two black people had robbed a store or something. Well, there was only one black person in this group, but just because he was black and the other person was dark, they were stopped and almost arrested until something came over the radio that said, we already got the suspects. The other night, when we had both our children in the car, 6-month-old in the car seat and a 7-year-old in the back seat, we didn't have current license plate tabs. And I was working on getting the emissions test in our car flunked, and I explained this to the police officer. He would not listen to Robert at all. He would not talk to Robert. He leaned his flashlight over Robert, who was the driver, and was, "What year is the car, ma'am? Is this registered in your name, ma'am?" And finally, after he had gone back and checked us out, found out we were, you know, okay and whatever, he came back and was doing it again, and all I said was, which as a feminist seemed like a very funny thing to me to say, "Ask my husband." He's got real angry and, you know, started threatening to take our car away and said that he could impound it if I was, what was the word? Yeah, because I was being, I was hostile. Yeah, and you know, but at least, you know, Robert has been served some subpoenas last summer, and out in Sandy, several times if he was parked, the neighbors would call the police. The police would come. One time, a police officer said to Robert, after Robert had been sort of shoved by this citizen with a club, that if you showed up at my doorstep serving something late in the evening, you'd be met at the door with a gun or something, you know, seeing the barrel of something. And that's an example of, I think it's wrong, but they are the only ones who at least admit it. Robert was going to say something about the inner city. Robert was going to say something about the inner city and the Spike Lee film that's out right now and the violence that's in there. And I think that's one thing that seems to be accurate in that film, too, is that at least it's acknowledged.
Yeah, that was the last thing I was going to try and point out is a friend of mine in New York, I used to go to classes and speak about the black experience in Minnesota. And after I had done it a couple times, I realized that it's better to have another person, because I can't represent the black experience. I'm only one person. So I brought my friend who was from New York. And he did it two or three times. And after that, he started to say, "Book, I'm not doing this anymore because these people don't care. I mean, I'm standing here and I'm trying to tell them what I think, and they just don't care. I mean, it doesn't make sense to me to keep doing this." I still disagree with that. I think that maybe most people don't care. You know, maybe most people are not going to run out with their banners and say, you know, "This needs to stop right now." But I do think it's important that people hear and hopefully understand that there are some differences, that there are some real problems, and not just understand it from a white sociologist position who has gone into the black community and has examined the situation and who understands it. I think it's important to hear from people who live in black communities, who grew up and who have one piece of understanding of what the black experience is, and hear what they want to have done about it. I just think very often it is dismissed, but I don't think the answer is to stop trying. And what I have found very interesting recently is Spike Lee's movie called Do the Right Thing. And again, it's very interesting that the movie is basically about searching for an answer, searching for some truth, some justice. I really recommend seeing the movie. And there's this controversial scene. When I saw the scene, I thought, I don't see any controversy. The controversy is a so-called riot where the director and the star of the movie throws a garbage can through the window of this pizza parlor and starts a riot. And everyone, or a lot of criticism, has come out saying that he's advocating violence, he's advocating destruction of property. And I think Spike Lee has pointed out some very important issues. And one issue is that generally black life is not real respected. Especially inner city, unemployed, black male life. I think most people don't see much value in that. And that really concerns me. I really hope that people will start to hear what I'm saying, what Spike Lee is saying, what other people are saying, and that is, if you continue to disrespect black life, you're going to get a very angry reaction, and it's going to make the problem so big that it could be unmanageable by the time anyone decides, well, we should do something about this. I'd recommend going to see the movie, give some serious thought to how you see black people, and even if it's a negative perception, like Shannon was saying, I think you people probably know more about how interracial relationships are perceived than we do, because the racism I get is this unfocused question about, well, what position do you play, or what do you think about Pierre Del Selby? And I don't know what to do with that. If someone asked me a specific question, like, well, what do you think should be done about the inner city problem in New York, then I have some ideas about that. Stop. Thanks, guys.
Okay. One thing I just wanted to add that I thought my wife would touch upon was part of her experience in the Paris ward. It was a young adult ward, and Guylaine had been in it for about 2 years when we got engaged. And it was a very mixed ward. There were probably a dozen cultures represented, and all of the races were in it. And they were all young people between the ages of, 18 and 30. And it had been organized for years, but there had never been an engagement before ours, and ours was the first marriage as well. And when Guylaine was engaged during the year that I was back here in school, And she was over there alone. She got a lot of persecution from people who told her that it was wrong that Spencer Kimball had said that intercultural marriages were too difficult and they should, and that we shouldn't attempt them. And but when it came down to the deadline and we were actually on the verge of getting married, it seemed as if the ward came together and had a very positive reaction. The people volunteered to help and make the cake and disc jockey the dance and everything. And the strongest critics shut up, and everybody was supportive. And then afterwards, when we were married, I guess, you know, it's too late, so we were tolerated. But what happened shortly afterwards was even more telling, was because afterwards people, other couples started forming and people started getting engaged, other mixed couples, Vietnamese, French, white and black, South American and American. And it seemed as if it had been accepted in that ward that interracial and intercultural marriages were against what the church taught, that miscegenation was a crime in the Lord's eyes, and that it was wrong. And then I think the reaction was especially strong because, well, Gilan says that I was respected in the ward, and I was seen as a standard American Mormon former missionary, you know, and I guess they assumed that, well, if he can do it, I guess it's okay for us to do it, you know. And it was as if they actually did make a transition between thinking that this was wrong to thinking that it was all right. And Gilan and I hope really that our relationship, you know, that it can have a positive influence. We were married for purely selfish reasons. Because we love each other and we feel good about being with each other. But we also hope that by being in the community and participating, and like Robert and Shannon said, when people are exposed to us for a short period of time, then they start to see that we are just people, that the problems in our marriage are the problems that are in every marriage. And if we wanted to take the Council Against Intercultural Marriages seriously, I think it would have to start with Utah Mormons refraining from marrying non-Utah Mormons. Okay. I'd like to field questions from the audience. Well, we'd like to field questions from the audience. Let's see. In the back, you were first.
Well, first, I agree that one incident or several incidents might not be racism, but racism in many instances, in a light form, is nothing but pigeonholing, is nothing but putting stereotypes and labels on people and deciding before you talk to them that this is what they are, this is who they are, who they might like. And, you know, it might not be a fixed thing. It might not be that you must be a football player, but you're black, you're built big, so you might be a football player. And when it happens over and over and over, when it's happened to us for over 2.5 years, the same questions, I think it when it takes on such a severe pattern is when it becomes more than just common curiosity.
I don't want to discourage any questions. That's actually, and this may be different. Well, probably not, but it is real different from what a lot of blacks think and what a lot of mixed relationships believe. They don't want to be noticed. That's when it gets to be real hard. But the only thing I want to say is that's kind of my point, is that people will not directly confront you and say, I want to know what you think as a black person about this situation. it's this thing that, I mean, you don't know what to do with it. Where, and that was the reason I brought that up, is because I was saying that it's easier in the South, because if somebody doesn't like you because you're black, they will say to your face, "I hate niggers, stay away from me." And you say, "Okay, I'll stay away from this person." It's real difficult in other situations when you don't know where it's coming from, you don't know what to do with it, but you can feel that there's something more going on there. So, and that's the thing I really want to stress, is I don't think there is such a thing as a stupid question. I want people to ask questions.
Well, personally, while Guylaine was going through her ordeal in France, I was going through my own. It was kind of a doctrinal face in the question, a doctrinal research into the questions that people most often posed, which were most often based in the Pearl of Great Price and in the Book of Mormon, where it talks about race and righteousness and foreordination. And personally, I have a hard time drawing a harmonization between the teachings of race and righteousness in the Book of Mormon and Doctrine and Covenants and the Atonement of Christ. If the Atonement of Christ was a universal atonement, it seems illogical to me, or even contradictory to me, that that would not extend to all the children of God. And unless we claim that certain races are not children of God, or that they've, or, you know, I don't know. You can make all kinds of rationalizations to justify belief in the, you know, in the themes in the Book of Mormon, that as people reject light, they become darker. But I personally don't, am not able to rationalize that. I think it would be much more advantageous to substitute, well, not to substitute, but to allegorize the teachings in the Book of Mormon. I don't feel comfortable saying that, but I, you know, from a doctrinal point of view. But I think that really we need to look at the contradiction in between that and between the teachings of the Atonement of Christ. And I'd go with the Atonement of Christ.
Thank you for that perception. We do realize, of course, that all Mormons are different, and that having a lay priesthood, that everybody does have a different interpretation. That just is one experience that happened to me at BYU by a BYU professor. And, you know, I agree. Ma'am?
I live in Atlanta, Georgia, but I spend a lot of time on BYU campus now as president of the alumni board for the School of Management. And one of the things we want to do is recruit good students there, you know, whether they're members or non-members, and have different races represented there. And so I'm wondering what the law school did. You know, why are you there? How were you recruited, so to speak, to go there? And did they do anything to make you feel comfortable in the community so that you would have a good experience? I'm really sad that you didn't have a better experience there, because that affects your, you know, the way you succeed in your studies and that kind of thing. That's part of your experience as a student there. And if they didn't, what could be done by a professional graduate program to integrate people coming from, and even another culture, as far as, you know, the Eastern versus the, or whatever, into the community or into the students? How well were you received by the students? Did your interracial marriage have an impact on that? That sort of. Talk to that, please.
That's a very typical question. Most people, when they find out I go to BYU Law School as opposed to the U, they immediately ask, "Why are you down there?" The biggest reason I came to BYU is, as I suggested in my little speech thing, My first contact with Mormons was through two missionaries who, I don't think either of them grew up in Utah. And, I mean, it was the first time a white male had ever been able to really convince me that he understood how it felt to be an outsider. I think, generally, and it's not, you know, I don't intend to go what our next door neighbor calls men bashing, but I think very often if you're within the power structure, it doesn't really occur to you to question it in the same way. I think that's often what happens in the Mormon leadership is, you know, you're within the structure, and in a certain way it doesn't occur to you to think, we might be messing up. We might really be leading these people off. And that's where some questions come from sometimes. Why did I come to BYU? I received, but not specifically, it wasn't direct. I don't think BYU does much, at least the law school anyway, I don't think they do much recruiting of minorities. I think it's just kind of whoever happens to show up. If they're qualified, they get in. I was reading through the pre-law handbook, and I saw what BYU had to say about itself, and I thought, this is where I want to go. And that's basically it. They said that they're a young school. They feel like they're progressive, and that's why I came here.
And then talked about, did they do anything for you once, you know, as a couple? Like, did they have a spouse program, or you didn't do anything, that kind of thing? You don't have to go on and on, but just, you know. That was part of my question, too.
Yeah, I don't remember anything special or different that was done for us. I don't know if there is on the undergrad side, but in the law school, I don't think there is anything.
One of the person, I think she left, but she said that if she sees a mixed couple, well, they are different, and she wonders, or if she will ask lots of questions about Selby and things like that. I think, well, it's just by curiosity, but the thing is, if I remember on campus, was it last year, the presidential election? Yeah. Okay. Last year on campus, we had a mock vote. The students just gathered, and we had to say who will vote. And a lot of students, they asked me if I voted for Jesse Jackson. And I said, well, actually, you know what? But I did. Just to make a statement. No, just to show that at BYU, then some student, well, then Jesse Jackson will have, even if he's radical, he'll have some vote at BYU. But later on, Stuart and I, of course, we talked about the presidential election, and well, Jesse Jackson for us, well, we don't really respect him because, well, we don't agree with him on his political views, and because of other things. But I don't like Jesse Jackson, well, because I don't like him as a politician, not because he's a black person, then I should vote for him. And the same thing is about a woman. If a woman run to be a president at BYU, in America, I'm not going to vote for that person because she's only a woman. I mean, because that's not rational. And also, I'd like to come back to what you said. I don't think we are paranoid or we have hallucinations. People here, they have prejudices. I mean, I will take an example. When we went to on Christmas, Stuart's sister lives in Tabione. It's a little town in Utah. I don't know if you have heard of it. We played with some kids. We went to her best friend's. It's a big family. They have like 7 kids, right? And we played with them. We talked with them. We sing song and everything. We had a really good time. We spent 3 days with them. And recently, Stuart was talking with his sister on the phone, and he told her, well, would you like to come to the panel and talk about your feelings and how you accepted our marriage? And she said, well, I wouldn't feel really comfortable because, well, I don't know how I can handle that. And so I said, well, he suggested, would you mind writing down your feelings and what you have heard about Dylan and I, because it's a little town where, and so it's really more interesting to have a little comment de sondage. a port or whatever, it will be more interesting because, well, it's close and it's in Utah. I mean, it's well, anyway. And she said, then her, I was very surprised because she said her, when we left, that man, he used to be a bishop and also a seminary teacher. He said all his kids and his wife, and he said, now you saw Gillian and Stuart. They are nice, intelligent. They played with you, and you feel good about that, about them. But there is one thing: it's not okay to marry another race, because it's not because you see them happy. Is that should not be for you a testimony than you if you find in your life a different person to marry that person. And I felt very, very hurt. It really hurt me because I ate with that man. I talked to that man. I played with his kids. I was with Stuart in his house, and we spent that whole week with them. And I wouldn't. It touched me because I wouldn't feel. I didn't even think that that man saw us as not only different, but he had to sit his kids and give them a speech about how being than the general authorities of the church stated some strong feelings about culture and racial marriages. And what is really hard to deal here is you. It's hard to say, no, well, you shouldn't think that way because it's racist. Because people, they appeal to authority. They say, but what you are doing is wrong because the prophet said that. I mean, he stand up in general authority and said that. The thing is, how can you... It's hard to deal with them because you cannot say, no, the prophet is wrong because he's the leader of the church. I mean, you are not going to say to stand up in a ward and say, no, they made a mistake, and if the black didn't have the priesthood for so many years, it can be explained why because Mormons, they are also like Americans, they had some influences of the outside about prejudice and things like that. It's really hard to talk, to have a rational talk with people about why the blacks were not in the church for so many years. And when you say then, if you see on campus, it will happen to you the same thing if you go somewhere else. Yes, fine. But the people, we have to deal with them on a secular basis. They don't have to appeal to their religion to say, my religion says that way. You know what I mean? It's a harder issue. No, that has nothing to do with excommunication, my dear.
He just suggested that possibly you will avoid a problem if you don't. And it was never said
yes,
wrong.
I agree. But
and
how...
You feel free.
Yeah, oh, I am free. I married my husband. It's the statement, my dear. No, well, what... Yes, what I'm saying is the church did make a statement. Interracial and intercultural marriage are not recommended. And some people, they can turn that in their way and use their prejudice and say the church doesn't agree with it. It happened to me. I'm an interracial marriage, and I know what happened to me. I'm not paranoid. And also, if I said, I agree with you. We agree on the same point, but I'm saying what people, how they deal with us. And the reason I'm told that story, it's because it's to say that I'm not paranoid. I felt comfortable in that man's house. I felt a family. It was on Christmas. My family is in France. And it really touched me that they could accept us to come with them. And it really hurt to hear when we left what he did. Because I would never do that to my children, to sit them and tell them that they should not marry another race or marry another culture and give them a speech. That's all.
Yeah, I think the church puts interracial marriages on the same level as Coca-Cola.
Yeah. The time is up. We can take a few more questions if you're interested, as long as they don't drive us out. Vicki?
I just have one question. Actually, it's more of a statement in a way. I'm sure all of you have seen it. It's a pamphlet that the church has had around for years, and everybody reads it. It's called Three Degrees of Glory, and it was a discourse written in 1964 by Melvin Ballard, in which he talks about foreordination and predestination and who we were in the pre-earth life. And what ends up saying, he says, is, why we don't know exactly why white people have beautiful, quote-unquote, white babies, and why black people have other ones. And it's just the language. Well, that was the language that was referred to. And it was very, very biased and was prejudiced. And the thing is, in the scriptures, what happens, too, is that we have two problems in the scriptures. There is a prejudice against the people, different tribes and people, just as there is a prejudice between colors, and there's a prejudice between male and female. And as they have a problem with racials, women have a problem with people, how you're spoken to and how you're regarded and your authority and the respect you have when you're when you give a talk or something. And I think that's what it basically boils down to. And I don't think Heavenly Father or any of the truly righteous...